Today, I'll ask Noam some of our most burning questions, and we'll discuss several topics about our world as we know it and as we hope to shape it. Noam, it's great to see you, and let's dig right in. So our first question, much has been in the news lately about shifting centers of world power, unipolar power, bipolar, multipolar. How do you think the future of the world is going to be shaped by the current crises that are rattling the system?
I should mention that there are two crises that will determine whether it's even worth talking about these issues. One of them is the growing threat of nuclear war. The other is the climate crisis, environmental crisis, which has to be dealt with in the next few years or else human society is essentially finished. So unless these two crises are properly met, everything else is moot. Let's assume somehow we'll be able to deal with them. Then we can talk about the current geopolitical crises, shifting centers of world power, unipolar versus multipolar, is very much in the news right now, just as the questioner pointed out. Actually, these are issues that go back to the end of the Second World War. They have a lot to do with something which is very live today, status of Europe. The end of the Second World War, of course, the U.S. had overwhelming power, dwarfed the rest of the world in wealth, power, security. So it was the dominant power in the world for the entire post-war period, really. There was a question as to whether Europe should carve an independent course in international affairs. Should it become what was called a third force,
right,
along the line suggested by Charles de Gaulle of France, Philippe Brandt in Germany, others? Mm-hmm. Or should it stay within what's called the Atlanticist framework, the NATO framework, basically run by the United States? That issue became very much alive when the Soviet Union collapsed, 1990-91. Mikhail Gorbachev, Soviet leader, proposed what he called a common European home from Lisbon to Vladivostok with no military alliances, no victors, no defeated, common work for a more or less social democratic future. Well, that didn't last very long. Go into the reasons. But coming up to the present, the question is, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia has brought this to the fore very sharply. The world is now very much divided on this. That's what the news is about. Almost the entire, outside of Europe, the United States, England, the U.S. allies, most of the world is calling for a diplomatic settlement to try to end the horrors before they get even worse. The United States position is different. U.S. position is formal position. The war must continue in order to severely weaken Russia. Well, the world is split on this. And it shows up in the framework of unipolar versus multipolar global organization. One effect of Putin's criminal invasion of Ukraine has been to end, at least temporarily, talk of an independent Europe. It's driven Europe completely under the control of the United States. So it's much to its detriment. It's suffering, going into industrial decline because of this, may continue. Its natural trading partners, Russia, not a strong economy. Its economy is about the level of Mexico, but an enormous source of resources and raw materials, minerals, and so on. Europe is short of those. It's economists call it a marriage made in heaven. It's a natural trading relationship, and it's been broken. And of course, this cuts off Europe's access to the markets in China, huge market for the German-based industrial system in Europe. China's been an enormous market. The U.S., which is insisting on the unipolar framework of world order, wants not only Europe, but the world to be incorporated within something like the NATO system. In fact, at its last NATO summit meeting, under U.S. pressure, NATO expanded its reach to the Indo-Pacific region. That means that NATO is now committed to taking part in the U.S. conflict with China. It's a global system. Most of the rest of the world is trying to develop a multipolar world with several independent sectors of power. So the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, Indonesia, South Africa, they want an independent source of power of their own. That's about 40% of the world economy. It's not small. Making independent relations with China, with Russia, independent of U.S. sanctions, independent of the U.S. dollar. So these are conflicts that are developing worldwide over one raging issue and one developing issue. The raging issue is the war in Ukraine. The developing issue is the U.S. conflict with China, which in the longer term is far more significant. The U.S. isn't, China is, of course, a second major power in the world. It's growing, developing, it's pursuing its own course, developing loan and investment and development projects throughout Eurasia, reaching to Africa, Middle East, South Asia, even to Latin America. It's now the major trading partner for Latin America, U.S., and the U.S. is determined to try to prevent Chinese economic development. The Biden administration has virtually declared kind of war with China, demanding that Western allies refuse to permit China to carry out technological development. The U.S. has sufficient control over elements of the advanced technology so that its U.S. laws now insist that others not allow China access to any technology that has any U.S. parts in it, which almost everything does because of the intricacy of international supply chains. So, for example, take, say, the Netherlands. Netherlands has the major lithographic industry, which produces critical parts for semiconductors, the source of the modern high-tech economy. Now, Netherlands has to decide whether, under U.S. demands, to lose the China market, its major market, or whether to move an independent course. Same is true for Samsung in South Korea, Japan. The world is really splintering on these lines.
Right. Let me follow up a bit on that with the growth of multinationals, right, and the strength of multinationals in the system. So what does governance look like in 50 to 100 years? Could multinationals be more powerful than elected or other types of governments?
Let's take a look at the situation right now, which is not much discussed. US-based multinationals control about half the wealth of the world. Phenomenal amount of power they're first or second in just about every domain, manufacturing, retail, name it. No one else is even close. That's extraordinary power. If you look at most of the discussions of relative world power, look at national GDP, gross domestic product. By that measure, the U.S. maybe has 20%, say, of the world's wealth. But if you look at U.S.-based multinationals, it's more like 50%. Well, that's extraordinary power. How is that going to develop in future years? Depends very much on the kinds of questions I was just talking about. Take Europe. The Europe-based industrial, it's mostly German-based industrial system, stretching from complex system, stretching from Netherlands to Slovakia. It is going into a period of decline right now because of the breaking of relationships, trade commercial relationships with the East. It's not clear whether Europeans are going to accept that. Will they go into economic decline while staying subordinate to U.S. power, or will they join most of the rest of the world and try to move towards a more complex, multipolar world in which they integrate with the countries of the East? The one European statesman who's been talking about this is Emmanuel Macron of France, who's being vilified and condemned for saying that we have to find some way after Russia has been driven out of Ukraine. We have to have some way to accommodate Russia within an international system that will allow us to develop in a sensible fashion. He's almost alone in that, but the rest of the world agrees with him outside of Europe and the United States. Well, as for the multinationals, they have enormous power over domestic policy, very extraordinary power in the domestic policy of the United States and other state capitalist countries. How are they going to act when they are told they cannot deal with one of their major markets? Take Apple Computers, biggest corporation in the world. One of their main markets is China. Are they going to agree to lose the China market? That's where, if you have an iPhone, it's probably assembled in China under the direction of a Taiwanese corporation, Foxconn. That's the way the world system works. U.S. is now trying to break that. U.S. has helped establish that system, of course. Now it's trying to dismantle it. Nobody knows how that's going to work out. But those are the processes that are taking place right at this moment.
Well, you mentioned a little bit ago about the threat of nuclear war, right? And so we'll keep with that international security theme for the next question. And we know that Russia recently suspended the New START nuclear arms treaty with the United States. And how important is this to the threat of nuclear war?
It's very significant. Russia announced that this is the last remaining arms control treaty, the New START treaty. The Trump administration almost canceled it. It was due to the extension of the treaty was due to expire last February, and Joe Biden took the presidency just in time to save the expansion that the Russians had been calling for, literally by a couple of days, or else that one would have been gone. Now, bear in mind that the United States was instrumental throughout the last half century in developing an arms control regime, which somewhat limited and mitigated the threat of nuclear war, which means terminal war. People are talking much too casually about nuclear war. There can't be a nuclear war. If there is, we're finished. That's why the famous doomsday clock is now set at 90 seconds to midnight, by far the closest it's ever been. So there was a arms control regime meticulously developed. Eisenhower, Kennedy, later presidents, Russians, and it had considerable significance. Well, starting the beginning of this century, George W. Bush, the U.S. began to dismantle it. Bush dismantled the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, a very significant component of the arms control system, and incidentally an enormous threat to Russia, because that means that with dismantling the treaty, the U.S. can set up these installations and is doing it right at the border of Russia, which is a severe threat to Russia. The Trump administration came along, got rid of the INF treaty, the Reagan-Gorbachev treaty of 1987, which ended short-range missiles in Europe, which were a tremendous threat, ended those. Okay, those are now back in. And to make it clearer that Trump meant it, he arranged to have missile launches right away, breaking the treaty, showing we really mean it's over. Trump destroyed the Open Skies Treaty, which went back to Eisenhower, which gave each side information about what the other was doing, so reduced the threat of misunderstanding, misapprehension, crises. The only thing that was left of the arms control regime was the New START Treaty. Mm-hmm. As I say, Biden just barely was able to save the extension. Russians have now suspended it. They say they'll continue to live up to it, but it's very important too. The treaty itself ends in 2026, so it's not that far away. Have to be negotiating right now to extend it. This is a treaty that restricts the number of strategic weapons that each side has. I mean, what they have is way beyond anything that's needed. Every military specialist will tell you that if the United States has two or three submarines, doesn't need anything else for deterrence. One Trident submarine can destroy a couple hundred cities all over the world. I mean, and some parts of the so-called triad, the three-pronged military system that the U.S. has, are a threat to the United States. Land-based ICBMs, they have no use whatsoever for deterrence. The Russians, of course, know exactly where they are. Chinese knows precisely where they are. If there's any ever conflict, first thing they'll do is take them out, which means that they're what's called in the trade, use them or lose them missiles. You got to use them right away or you're finished. That means if there's a threat, you better send them off. Maybe the threat was like hundreds of times in the past, just an accident. Okay. So they're a threat to the United States. They're kept there mostly under congressional pressure. Some congressional representative in some rural area doesn't want to lose the ICBMs. They're part of the economy. So for such reasons, we're severely endangering ourselves. I think any arms control specialist can spell this out for you. But the New START Treaty did restrict the enormous excessive number of strategic weapons, and it's important. So we should be negotiating right now to expand it, restore it, and also reinstitute the treaties that the U.S. has dismantled. The INF Treaty, the Reagan-Gorbachev Treaty, ABM Treaty, Open Starts Treaty, they should all be coming back.
Right, definitely important for our future survival. So we'll shift gears slightly now. The audience was interested in how or if our current society will muster the will for change, for equity, prosperity, and sustainability, and what you think about that.
It's a very interesting and important question. There's no answer. The answer's in the mind of every one of you. It's up to the population to say, we're not going to march to the precipice and fall over it. That's exactly what our leaders are telling us to do. Right now, take the environmental crisis. It's well understood that we have maybe a couple of decades in which we can control the heating of the environment, the destruction of habitat, which is the destruction of the oceans, which is just going to lead to total catastrophe. It's not that everybody's going to die at once, but we're going to reach irreversible tipping points. After that, it's just steady decline. You want to know how serious this is? Look at particular areas of the world. So take the area where most of the fossil fuels are generated. Actually, the U.S. is the leader, but secondarily, the Middle East region. The Middle East region is one of the most rapidly heating regions of the world. It's expected about twice as high as other regions. Projections by the end of the century under the current trajectory are that the sea level in the Mediterranean will rise about 10 feet. Just take a look at the map and where people live. I mean, it's indescribable. South Asia, peasants in India are trying to survive temperatures in the 120s Fahrenheit. No air, of course, less than 10% of the population even has air conditioning. They're sort of trying to survive in mud huts and so on. Unlivable. You can't. There's going to be there's going to be enormous migration where people fleeing from huge areas of the world which are uninhabitable. Right now, Europe is telling them go drown in the Mediterranean. Well, what's going to happen when there's hundreds of thousands of them? What's coming is completely unspeakable with regard to nuclear. The fossil fuel companies love it. And profits are just going through the roof. Profits are so high now that they've abandoned their limited efforts for sustainable energy because destroying the world is much more profitable. So put aside sustainable energy. Let's produce more fossil fuels, open more fields, produce for the next 30 or 40 years, by which point we'll all be finished. Okay. That's with nuclear weapons, it's the same thing. So do we have the will to change that? The answer had better be yes. The rest of the human experiment is finished, not in the distant future. The lifetimes of our grandchildren. We're not talking about eons from now. Well, do we have the will? It's up to you to decide.
Thank you. And how do we muster that will? How do we get people energized to try to act for the better good on some of these issues?
Talk to your neighbors, organize in your community, join the activist groups, press Congress, endless numbers of opportunities. And ask yourself, how have things happened in the past? So there was a major women's movement, probably the major movement of the past half century. How did it start? Well, go back to the, of course, it goes way back, but go back to the 60s. Small groups of women, mostly young women, got together, forming consciousness-raising groups, saying, a lot of it, incidentally, in the left movements, saying, do we have to just be the secretaries and the people who serve the tea and the coffee, or should we take part in it? It was a big change, and it happened. Small groups grew to larger groups, got to a major movement, demonstrations, activism, pressure, laws changing. We may forget that it wasn't until 1975, not that long ago, that women were granted the right of persons, peers, under U.S. domestic law. prior to that, we're still back in the age of the founding fathers, when women were property, not persons, owned by the father, handed over to the husband. That was technically the law up until 1975. Well, it's really changed. Not enough, but enormously. How did it start again? Small groups of people meeting, mostly young people, saying, we don't have to put up with this. Take a look at the civil rights movement. Go back to the 50s. I mean, again, goes far back. 50s, Rosa Parks refused to move her seat on the bus. That was planned. It was an organized effort by activists who planned the activity. Led to the Montgomery bus boycott. Big change. 1960, a couple of black students in North Carolina decided to sit in at a lunch counter, segregated, of course. They were immediately arrested. Could have been the end of it, except the next day, another group came. Right. Later, they became organized. SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Young people from the North started to join. Pretty soon you had freedom buses running through Alabama trying to convince black farmers to take their lives in their hands and cast a vote. Well, pretty soon goes on. You get civil rights legislation in Washington. It's not the end of the story. It goes on and on today too, right now. But that's the way movements develop. It's what's happening right now. So take the Biden administration. They just passed something called the Inflation Reduction Act. It's mostly a climate change act. It uses, in our crazy system, the only way you can get fossil fuel companies and banks to stop destroying the world is to bribe them. That's the way our system works. Maybe if we bribe them, they'll stop destroying the world. Maybe if the Mexican government bribes the cartels, they'll stop killing people. That's basically our system. Well, doesn't work very well. That's the Biden program. Try to bribe them to do something else. They're after profit. If they can make money on it, okay. If not, they'll turn back to fossil fuels, what they're doing. But at least something is there. There is a program which is better than any that preceded. It's not the program that Biden presented. The program that Biden presented was a substantial program dealing with climate change. A lot of it came out of Bernie Sanders' office. The background for that, young people, people from Sunrise Movement who were active and organizing, got to the point where they sat in on congressional offices, sat in on Nancy Pelosi's office. Well, again, ordinarily the Capitol Police would come and throw them out. That didn't happen this time. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined them. That was enough to keep them there, pay attention to them. Why was she able to do that? Because she was elected on the Sanders wave, which was, again, lots of local organizing and activism. Well, there was a substantial program, was cut back by 100% Republican opposition. You have to recognize, like it or not, the Republicans are a denialist party. They don't want to do anything for climate change. They want to destroy the world in the interests of private profit for the corporations they serve. It's as simple as that. So 100% Republican opposition, a couple of right-wing Democrats, our own Senator Sinema, mainly Joe Manchin, just blocked it. So it was cut back, shaved down to the act that was finally passed, which is not nothing, but nowhere near enough. Well, what can you do? All the things that led to these actions, just more of them, right where you are, at any level, there's endless numbers of opportunities. There are enormous needs for educational opportunity, for education. Let me just give you a striking illustration. There's a research institute, the Pew Research Institute, which comes out regularly with extensive studies of popular attitudes. The last one, a couple weeks ago, gave people 21 choices and asked them to rank them in terms of urgency. Which ones do you think are the most important? Well, nuclear war was not even listed among the choices. It's considered so remote from concern that we don't even ask people. It's only the most important issue that's ever arisen in human history. Do we need some education? You bet. Climate change was listed. Do you know where it was ranked? At the very bottom, 21st out of 21. There was a big gap between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans, 13%, thought it was a significant issue. It's just the issue that's going to destroy human life on Earth, along with millions of other species that we're destroying. Okay? Is there room for educational work? I mean, it's vast. And that has to start the way other things have started. Talk to your neighbor, talk to people around you, talk to people at work, get together in groups, join the larger groups, get out in the streets if it's necessary, pressure Congress. It's a very free country, fortunately. You're not going to be tossed into jail for doing it. It's all up to you.
Right. So at the Wonder House at South by Southwest, we do have faculty who are sharing the work that they're doing to try to make the world better. Do you have any advice for ensuring that we have research investment, that we can work on increasing trust in institutions, or thoughts on ways that we should act differently to ensure that there continues to be work for the global public good in the future?
Well, the lack of trust in institutions is an extremely serious matter, and it has deep roots. Remember that we have lived through 40 years, the last 40 years, of a major assault on the population. It's called neoliberalism. It's presented, take a course in it or read a book, look at the Britannia, Wikipedia, they'll tell you it means commitment to markets. That's about half true. It's commitment to markets and bailouts. Those two things go together. You start deregulating, especially finance, started late Carter, Reagan administration, start deregulating. You get all kind of efforts to make large profits. They work fine up to the point where they crash. What happens when they crash? You go to the friendly taxpayer who bails you out. There weren't any financial crises in the 50s and the 60s when finance was regulated. Banks were banks. Starting with Reagan, right away, crisis after crisis, each one gets worse. Every time those responsible for the crisis get bailed out. So that's basic neoliberalism. It's kind of class war. And it's had an effect. There are estimates. So the RAND Corporation, super respectable, did a study in which they estimated that about $50 trillion had been transferred from the lower 90% of the population to the top 1% during these 50 years of bitter, brutal class war. It's left people with labor unions were destroyed, the means of defense. People may have jobs, but they're precarious jobs, uncertain. majority of the populations get along from paycheck to paycheck. Why should they have trusted institutions? Look at what the institutions have done to them. So yes, they lack trusted institutions. Furthermore, this is fostered by conscious, careful corporate propaganda. Start with the fossil fuel industries. For them, it's extremely important to bar regulation. If you stop them from poisoning the environment, destroying the world, they can't make profit. So for years, they've been working hard to try to develop opposition to science. It's very good studies of this by historian of science, Naomi Oreskes. The idea is make people distrust science. If they distrust science, they'll distrust science-based regulations. We can make more profit. We can destroy the world more quickly. This is spread very widely to anti-science movements. Anti-vaccine movements are a case in point. A couple of days ago, it's hard to believe, a county in Georgia, Republican county, initiated legislation to bar vaccines, what they call jabs. Bar jabs, which are an effort by foreign countries to commit genocide in the United States. Okay, that's extreme, admittedly, but it's part of what's happening very broadly. A lot of it goes back to the efforts, conscious efforts, to destroy faith in science, in government, and other institutions so that we can make more profit and race towards destruction. That's neoliberalism, and it's had a major effect. People do distrust institutions. There's anger, resentment, easy targets for demagogues. It's not just the United States, happening in the rest of the world, similar processes. All of this has to be reversed. It's major efforts required.
Well, you've talked about this rise of anti-science movements, and I see that as part and parcel of a rise of anti-intellectualism that we've seen lately. And why do you think we've seen this rise in anti-intellectualism? And do you think it's ever justified?
It's justified to ask scientists, political scientists, social analysts, economists, to ask them to justify their conclusions. Just because they say it doesn't necessarily make it true. Every scientist knows this. Yes, science is a matter of interchange, debate, discussion, proposals, refutation, improvement, and so on. Nothing's ever certain. There's no certainty in the empirical world. It's been understood for centuries. So it makes sense to ask for reasoned justification. But to carry that to the point of anti-science or general anti-intellectualism is just to ask for self-destruction. Well, it's an old story in the United States. It goes back to its origins. The United States is quite unlike other societies, other rich societies in many ways. But one of them is the enormous role of extremist religious movements. The United States has a long history of great awakenings. Take a look at, when I was a college student, pretty long ago, but not that long, if you took a course in, say, sociology at the Ivy League institution where I was, University of Pennsylvania, a professor had to tell you, if this is getting to a section on evolution, saying, you don't have to believe this, but you ought to know what other people think. It doesn't happen in other countries. I mean, up until today, small percentage of the population believes in what scientists call the theory of evolution. maybe about half believe in church guided, God, divine guided evolution. The rest just say the world was created a couple thousand years ago, including people in high office like the vice president, the secretary of the state, evangelical Christians. These are unusual features of the United States. Going back, all sorts of reasons for it, but it's so there is a background of history of anti-intellectualism, which shows up. And right now you have extreme versions of it. So take Florida. Governor DeSantis is in the lead and trying to ensure that children not be allowed to study history, can't study history. His latest book says you can't have educational programs which study history except American history, except as saying the country has always been fully dedicated to the achievement of the rights that were called for in the Declaration of Independence. It's not history. You take any country in the way, the Trump administration was trying to pass laws saying you can't teach things that will be divisive or that will make children feel uncomfortable. That's history. There's no country in the world where history doesn't make you feel uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. You want to understand the world? You got to know those things. No, you're not allowed to. We have to have a totalitarian society where children are taught patriotic slogans to repeat and nothing else. That's anti-intellectualism with a vengeance. There are dozens of states now which have legislation, Republican states, which are throwing books out of libraries, forcing librarians to justify themselves if they have books on the shelves that some parent doesn't like. Things like that don't happen in advanced societies, not in most others either. That's happening here. This is a kind of anti-intellectualism which has always been an undercurrent, but is now reaching points that are extraordinarily dangerous. Connects with the anti-science movements we were talking about before.
Why do you think we're seeing this now? Why do you think it's reaching a crescendo now?
Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, notice that it's party-based. It's the Republican Party, almost totally. For the last couple of decades, the Republican Party has just departed from normal parliamentary politics. It's not a normal political party anymore. Not my opinion. It's standard political science discussion. People like Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute described the Republican Party in the last couple of decades as a radical insurgency that has abandoned parliamentary politics. And it's dedicated to trying to maintain power, however it's done as a minority party, by legislation, by other means. This is a real serious threat to the existence of functioning democracy. Democracy is a pretty fragile plant. It barely functions anyway. You start tearing it out by the roots, it's not going to last long. And in fact, we can see what's happening clearly. It's not a secret. In Europe, the Eastern countries, Hungary, Poland, are called illiberal democracies, highly autocratic. Government powers controls media openly, free discussion, academic institutions, undermines the basis for functioning of democracy, even if you have democratic forms. Leader of this is Viktor Orban in Hungary. He's quite frankly open about it. He's the darling of the Republican Party. There was a meeting international meeting in Hungary a couple of months ago of the most reactionary parties and movements in Europe, many with neo-fascist origins, who attended it. Conservative Action, Political Action Caucus, which is the core of the Republican Party, was then President, ex-President Trump gave a speech lauding Hungary as the forefront of civilization. Tucker Carlson, leading television personality, practically worships it. A couple months later, there was a meeting in Dallas, Texas, organized by the Conservative Political Action Caucus, keynote speaker Viktor Orban. That's where they want us to go. Let's become a formal democracy with no functioning democracy. It's not far. There are elements in Europe which are similar. Here, it's a major political party, the one which is now has control of the House, Supreme Court, hoping to move on to total control. Well, that's the situation we're in. And I stress again that it's 100% denialist. Either denies totally that global warming is taking place or says we shouldn't do anything about it.
Finally, do we have a future as a country, as a species, and as a planet?
That answer will be decided within the next few decades. Will we survive as a country if the human species survives? The country will survive. What kind of country will it be? Will it be a country that's an illiberal democracy in the form of modeled on Orban's Hungary or the Law and Order Party of Poland, which is not that different? Or will it be a functioning democracy to the extent that it is in the manner of other advanced countries and many others? We'll decide that here. Question about whether the species will survive. That's a gloomy prospect right now. The leadership is working to undermine those possibilities. There, take our own country. The Biden administration did have a climate program that's pretty much disappeared. There's few pieces of it left. Meanwhile, it's calling for opening up new fields for development. Right now, an enormous new field in Alaska, others in the country, to ensure that fossil fuels will continue to be produced for the next 30 or 40 years, which means we're finished. That carries us over irreversible tipping points, then down to disaster. We are in U.S. official policy now. It's planning strategic policy started under Trump, picked up by Biden, is preparation for two simultaneous wars with Russia and China, nuclear armed powers. There's no word for it. It's beyond insanity. You cannot engage in a nuclear war with any power that has more than a handful of nuclear weapons. It's just disaster. If a country launches a first strike, it'll be destroyed, even without retaliation, just from the effects of nuclear winter. We have to be moving in the exact opposite direction, reducing the crazy military systems instead of expanding them. Right now there are moves towards hypersonic missiles, 10 times the speed of sound. No way to prevent them. We're just asking for destruction. It's got to stop. And we have to have a sharp reversal of programs on destroying the environment. If we don't do that, we will not survive as a livable species. I might maybe end by quoting Albert Einstein, who was asked once what weapons he thought would be used in a third world war. He said, "I don't know what weapons will be used in the third world war, but the fourth world war will be fought with stone axes." Well, that's where we now stand.
Right. Well, Noam, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share your thoughts on the world with us. I know our students love spending time with you, and we're privileged to work with you at the University of Arizona, and we're privileged to call the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences the home of Noam. So thank you again, Noam, and thank you, South by Southwest 2023, and we appreciate you listening.
Thank you very much. It's my privilege.